From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hi, it's Victoria Bell here, Chief Reporter at CityWire New Model Advisor. Last month, I hosted a panel at the Leadership Summit on growth in the digital age. Here's what we discussed. So all of these advisors, they all run their own firms. So we have Keith Boyce from Spentwell, Nicola and Jennifer Ellis from Wellington Wealth, Carl Pemberton from Active Financial Planners, and Alistair Walker from Optimum Financial Planning, which has just rebranded from Handford, Aitkenhead and Walker. We'll get to that. But I think the first question that I'm going to direct to all my panelists is, how do you define your niche? And Keith, I think we'll start with you. You're the youngest firm here, and your firm has been around for 5 years.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that.
Well, I actually think all my clients must really love nachos and salsa, because that's the first thing they see when they go on my website. So I must quiz them on that. But ultimately, the clients we attract, our niche, if you like, is those that want simple messaging, those that are turned off by the typical industry jargon that we see, and really want to be taken on a journey. So it's more you-focused. So rather than bamboozling them with all the jargon, we actually focus on them, their journey. Right. So that's ultimately where we focus. Yeah. And that's using great visuals, great analogies, great stories along the way.
Great, thank you. What about Wellington Wealth?
Sisters in business together, and we help individuals, business owners, entrepreneurs, and we look for two things as our niche, I suppose, from clients. And the first one is that they're nice people, because potentially you've got decades of a relationship together. But the second thing is they've already got an engagement with their finances, and they're already engaged and willing to work together and collaborate. Mm.
Carl, what about yourself?
Yeah, so we're a regional chartered financial planning firm. We're in our 25th year this year. And many of our advisors actually came through the old banking background in terms of our history. So we felt when we established that there was a big gap between what are the big national providers and the smaller independent providers. So we really wanted to cater for those medium to high net worth individuals and give them an alternative to the big nationals.
Yeah. And Alistair, we'll talk about, I mean, your firm has been around for 47 years. We talked about you just rebranding. I mean, has the type of client that you go after sort of changed since that rebrand?
Yeah, definitely. The business is older than me. I feel obliged to say that, just in case anyone was wondering what face cream I use. I joined a mature business that was quite a bit smaller than we are today. And I remember we first started thinking about niches when Phil Bray at Yardstick challenged us on it when we first worked with him about 7 or 8 years ago. I think that was the last rebrand we did. And we went, we'll pretty much work with anybody who'll work with us. We need them to be interested in pensions. And I think the website ended up saying, if you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s or 70s, and you're thinking about your retirement in some way, talk to us, which didn't really niche us down very much.
Yeah.
We've spent a bit more time thinking about that since, and post the rebrand, so we changed from HJNW to Optimum Path Financial Planning. What we realized was other people we like dealing with as planners have similar characteristics. They tend to be what I would describe as knowledge workers, so people who are paid to use their brain. Might be academics, engineers, accountants, solicitors. And they're really engaged with their financial planning. So all of our rebrand marketing is about those two things, knowledge workers who are engaged with their financial planning.
And Wellington Wealth, you mentioned nice people. I mean, how do you sort of appeal to nice people?
I mean, we just set out to set up a business that we would want to deal with. That's what we initially aimed for. And I think just putting our own stamp. I mean, it's quite unusual being female business leaders in this industry. It's quite unusual being sisters in this industry at the top. So we just set up a business that we would like to deal with. Mm. And that's how, you know, we get an interesting bunch of people that come to us. And when Nicola mentioned engagement, we do have a very sort of, I would say, an onboarding process, for want of a better word, that kind of people work through. And if they're not willing to sort of engage with that, we know they're not the right type of client for us. Mm. And that's been quite important, I think, in our journey of niching clients, if you like.
But, and how do you actually appeal to these? What, do you use social media at all? I mean, Keith, your clients tend to be in the sort of 40 age range. So how much do you use sort of LinkedIn?
Yeah, so average age of our clients is about 44, 45. And about a third of our clients have come from social media. So, and that's really by taking an education-first approach. Mm. So I think we've got a big barrier in industry. I think money is a barrier for anyone, regardless of where you are. So I've used social media to break down that barrier by educating people around foundational elements around money management and some of the key principles around retirement planning and so on, to give them something they can run with. And I think that breaks down a barrier and then creates opportunities.
Carl, what about yourself?
Yeah, I think when it comes to social media, I think that it can be a cesspool at times as well, can it? It can be very busy and it can be very noisy. So I think if you use social media, it's got to be done strategically. And, you know, we do that in terms of LinkedIn, again, by virtue of the fact that we want most of our clients to be of that medium to high net worth. We want them to be business clients, and we would therefore assume a lot of them are on those platforms rather than an Instagram or a Facebook per se. So yeah, I think strategic marketing through social media can be absolutely fantastic if you get it right. And there's a lot of, going back to Peter's slides earlier, there's a lot of training, there's a lot of, you know, you've got to open your eyes and ears and you've got to learn, and quite often you get things wrong first before you actually nail it and get it right.
Sorry, how would you get things wrong? Give me an example.
I think sometimes on social media you can overthink things. Mm. I think things you can be sometimes a bit too cold and a bit bland. So again, it comes back down to your brand and your target audience and who we all are as individuals, who our firms are, who your firms are, and ultimately try and put some personality into that. Because if you can personalise posts or paid posts, certainly, you know, you're going to target more of your ideal type of client. And if it's nice clients, high net worth clients, younger clients, whatever it may be, you've got to talk in a language that's going to appeal to those people. So it's not about what you want to say necessarily. Sometimes it's about what's going to engage with those people who are going to be reading it on the other side.
Keith, I see you nodding.
It's such a great point, because it's so easy. We can all talk technical. We can all literally throw the textbook at the client, which on occasions we do. Mm. Clients don't really engage with that. So it's so true. If you personalise that and put your spin on it, and it's you, no one else can replicate that, because it's your spin, it's your upbringing, you're putting this influence into your story or narrative you're creating, that then creates such an authentic voice that people can engage with.
Mm. What about you, Alistair? Do you use social media?
I was listening to all these guys and thinking, oh, we really should be thinking harder about social media. because of the type of clients that I tend to deal with, what I find works better than LinkedIn posts or just check that everyone can hear me. I think the mic might be. Are we all okay?
Oh.
Okay, cool. Rather than use social media, I've ended up giving comments to news articles or writing content for actually quite technical, to your point.
No, that's
quite
okay.
Technical resources. not with a plan to use that for marketing to clients, but then clients will tend to find us via those sorts of things. So coming back to that engagement point, we kind of meet our clients where they're at in our circles, weirdly, because they're so focused on, I need to find a financial planner who really gets this aspect of what I need. And they seek us out through maybe unusual avenues.
Yeah. So behind it all, everybody wants to grow their business. I suppose I want to ask a question around growth targets. So I think, Keith, I feel like I'm picking on you, but as the youngest firm, I mean, when you started out, what was your growth target? And I suppose, has technology changed that at all?
Yeah, so I launched my firm in August 19, so just prior to COVID, so that was quite an interesting time to launch a business. My wife was quite delighted with that, but we're now 5 years in that journey. I think in financial service, I think we've got Oompa Loompa problems. So we love chocolate. We want more chocolate. We want to keep consuming it in generate growth, but then we don't think about what comes behind that, so the process and everything behind it. So yes, as a firm, we have growth targets, but it's doing it in a sustainable way. So it's thinking deeply about the process behind that. And I think ultimately with the technology that's coming in now, AI and so on, and other guys can leverage this point, that's creating more opportunities, and that's quite exciting. And it's taken us from being this really nice local firm in our community to now being national and having a no-limits mindset.
I suppose, how many clients do you actually serve?
I've got 70 that I look after.
70 clients, yes. Okay. And I suppose, you said that, you're a one-man band, aren't you? So what kind of technology do you use?
So, as a one-man band, you have to be incredibly efficient with your time. That's hugely important. So where I can, I leverage tech. So one simple example is using AI for meeting notes. And I have so many chats with people who spend 2 hours after a meeting writing the notes, and they tell me, this has great value and so on. Otter sits in the room with me, and it does it automatically, and it summarizes all my actions. It's phenomenal. And that takes 2 hours that I would otherwise be wasting doing that. And then I can deploy that to meeting another client and so on. So there's one example.
Carl, you have quite a lot of clients. I think it's 2,700 clients altogether at Active. I wonder, how much do you use technology?
So I was thinking about this before we came up here, and I was trying to think of a way of summarising it. If I was an investment company, I would be graded BBB. So I'm not at the forefront of technology, and I'm not going to be the type of person who's right at the front of the pack, dipping my toe straight in, but I'll happily wait in the wings and wait until it's proven, tried and tested before I'll jump on it. Right. So I'm not at the forefront, but I'm at just slightly behind there. Having said that, sort of through our 25-year journey, we were very early adapters to technology, and that's what's allowed us to grow quite significantly over those 25 years. So again, taking on Keith's point, it's massively valuable when it comes to growing a business and actually having those growth targets and ultimately being able to prove how you deliver that. Technology, as we probably all admit, over the last certainly 5 years, I would say, has moved at a hell of a pace. It's moved at a hell of a pace that I'm not necessarily young anymore, but I'm not necessarily old either, but it's going at a pace that even I can't keep up with. So we're at the stage where, we need to kick on for that next stage of technology, but I'm just a bit hesitant because I think we're in a period of flux at the moment with so many new things are actually coming out. There's so many things that are unproven. And I'm sort of just scared to jump into that next realm. As a sizable business, the consequences of getting it wrong can actually be... more damage than the potential upside. So I'm in this middle phase at the moment.
Alistair, I suspect that you are not in Carl's phase. You are very much a technology-driven firm. What kind of technology do you use?
We've got quite an interesting contradiction because we're a 47-year-old business. So we have a lot of clients who've come on quite a lot of that journey with us. Who were used to a very different way of dealing with an advisor. The story about Jim, who ran the business for 25 years, was he was the first advisor in Leicester to have a desktop computer on his desk. And that was within working memory of a lot of the clients that we deal with. So we have to be really careful not to sort of thrust new technology down sort of at our clients and say, this is what we're going to use, deal with it. But at the same time, I co-founded the AI Lab with Heather Hopkins at NextWealth, and we have this great community of people who are sharing really forward-thinking usage of AI. And selfishly, I mostly set that up so I could hear all those stories first and work out how to adapt those to our business. So we are really trying to use tactically delivered AI and tech solutions where it can do one of two things. And I think you've got to be really focused on what the objective is. And the objective has either got to be a marked service improvement, So a clear improved outcome for client at relatively low cost because it's delivered by tech, or a marked time saving, so an improved ROI on the sort of cost end.
Mm. Yeah.
The problem with the phase we're in, to your point, Carl, I think, is that we're in the people just having a go because stuff looks interesting.
Yeah.
Without that kind of focus on what problem am I trying to solve here?
Yeah.
With the tech.
Yeah. Nicola and Jennifer, what are your thoughts on how much do you use AI?
I mean, I think the interesting thing about this industry is probably every single person in this room has a firm that is totally different. And that's what is nice about it, because you speak to different people and they're approaching it differently. They're listening to different things. They're trying out different things. And like some people's attitude to growth is you know, the tortoise in the hare, I suppose. And we probably have been the tortoise, because we only really focus on 5 quality clients a year, and that's all we want every year. Yeah. To take onto the business. Obviously, if some clients, you know, drop off the list for unfortunate reasons, a client death or something, then, you know, we would add an extra one that year. But we don't try to shoot the lights out. We're a slow, steady growth, organic. And every single year, I think, even though that's been our target, we've you know, exceeded that. It's and that's just word of mouth. And because what's really important to us is the service and making sure that service is there and the client care is there. And technology plays a very big part in that.
Yeah. I suppose we can't talk about technology without talking about Zoom and Teams and how much you talk to your clients on Zoom and Teams. I think, Keith, you said that you use video quite a lot.
Yeah, so during COVID, as many of us had to do, we pivoted to video in that environment, and then we've carried that forward since that point. And I found that using video has been phenomenal for us as a business. It allows us to leverage us. It makes a small firm become a big firm, because we can service clients not only in Edinburgh, which is where we're based, but we've got clients from the north down the south and to the west and east and so on. Now I know everyone else does as well, but a lot of the time you're traveling. So that may be 5 hours of travel. I can literally flick to 5 meetings in that space of time. Not that I would do 5 meetings in 5 hours, but it simply leverages time, which is a wonderful tool. And then you've also got clients in their own space, so they're comfortable in their own space. And yes, people perceive screen as a barrier, but I don't know, I think it creates opportunities there.
Do you ever meet clients sort of face-to-face?
9 out of 10 clients are over video.
Right.
If they want face-to-face, I will do that.
Does that create a bit of a trust sort of barrier?
I think it comes back to how you deliver that service in the meeting.
Yeah.
So I like to think I'm at the point 5 years in where I'm skilled enough where I can get them comfortable. They're already comfortable because they're in their own space. Sometimes I'll send them little gifts in advance, some chocolates or tea or coffee to warm them up. And then I think it's just natural conversation. You just warm up with each other, and eventually you forget you're talking through a screen. It becomes quite natural.
Oh, for sure. Jennifer and Nicola, I think you mentioned that you have clients come to your office. You very rarely travel to them. So I suppose if you are doing a Teams meeting, do you reckon that you lose something?
So I would say we're almost the polar opposite of Keith in that the majority of clients come to our offices. You know, Teams is great for certain conversations, I would say, but some of the big, big conversations, clients want to see the whites of your eyes. They want to sit in front of you and get, you know, to my mind, certain conversations I would want to. I'm a people person, so maybe it's down to your own values and what you would perceive. But we deliberately created what we call our financial planning studio, our offices, to be almost a home from home. It doesn't look like a typical office. No matter if somebody's been 18 or 80 when they've come in, they've said, "Oh, I could live here." It's kind of, you know, quite a relaxed atmosphere, because again, you don't want to go into a stuffy environment. You want to be relaxed and comfortable talking about your finances. That has worked for our client base.
Yeah.
I mean, based in Glasgow as well, Scottish people, you know, obviously there's an image of the canny Scot, and people just want to make sure that their money is been put to good use. And Glaswegians love speaking to people as well. Mm. So people like coming in for a conversation like that. We do, of course, offer Zoom and Teams, and we have clients up and down the country, and sometimes it's not practical. So we do have meetings that way as well. But we do have an awful lot of meetings still in the office.
Carl, what do Active do?
Yeah, I'm probably a bit more traditional in my approach that I think face-to-face is the best way to create a strong relationship. Certainly, again, for the type of clients that we're looking for. But I think the Teams and Zoom approach is probably the one thing we've got to be grateful for COVID for, because it forced everybody to do it. I think if it was still a choice, we'd still be umming and ahhing and we wouldn't be as advanced as we are. At least it proved to the mass majority of people around the world that it can be done and it is fairly reliable. And I think as a business, going back to strategy and such like, I think it gives people the choice and it sort of takes away those boundaries of where you would normally operate if you did have geographical boundaries. Those walls are firmly down now, so there should be no limit in terms of where you can actually attract clients from. So yeah. I would say probably 10% of our meetings are consistently on Zoom or Teams, but it certainly helps for more of the ad hoc meetings. If a client just wants a quick catch-up, you're more likely to put it on a Teams or an online call than face-to-face.
Yeah. Do any of you use WhatsApp to contact your clients? Or no? Just, you know.
I get a few WhatsApps from clients that I would say I've got a strong relationship with.
Yeah.
But again, that's another conversation, because how do you put an out-of-office on WhatsApp? I've not sussed that out yet. And it sometimes frustrates me when you're on holiday or you're trying to have downtime and your WhatsApps are still going. Yeah. So I try not to.
Okay. Alistair, are you a face-to-face man or Teams?
I feel like this set me up perfectly because I'm pretty much smack bang in the middle. Some of my best relationships with clients are people I've never met face-to-face, and we've worked purely remote. Mm. Some of my best relationships with clients are people where I see them a couple of times a year in the office. I'm completely agnostic to how we work. For those who are remote, it tends to be people who have sought us out, so they might be anywhere in the country. What I have noticed is the relationship tends to work better if we have met face-to-face.
Mm, yeah.
So we've ended up with this sort of cadence where we'll meet certainly at outset and again see the whites of their eyes and they kind of know you're a real person and not an AI avatar or something. And then from then on, the relationship can work just the same as if we were in the office, purely remotely.
And they go to your office, you don't go to visit their homes.
Yeah.
Okay, lovely.
I also think it depends on the sort of average age of your clients as well, which is quite important. Because obviously people that are maybe pre-retirement are busy people, they just want a quick meeting or a quicker meeting, and maybe Teams and Zoom facilitate that.
Yeah.
Whereas some people in retirement love coming in for that chat because some don't have families, some want, you know, a bit more than just talking about their finances.
Yeah.
There's more to it than just that.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to cater for everybody.
Yeah.
And also sort of neurodiverse people are you need to cater to what the client wants as well.
Yeah.
So you've got to offer quite a wide range of options
ready for
individuals.
And I suppose vulnerable clients as well. I mean, I suppose if we're talking about growth, I mean, you know, you can't talk about growth without talking about the advisors who are trying to whittle down their clients because they're perhaps seen as lower value. I mean, is anybody here looking at that? Alistair, why don't we?
Yeah, part of our niching exercise was having a really good hard look at how we dealt with clients that we might have started a relationship with 15 or 20 years ago. And the kind of work that we do now is very different from the work that we did then. I joked, it's like there was a phrase that they used, some celebrity said conscious uncoupling when they were talking about a divorce. But that's what it feels like. We have a conversation with clients. Consumer Duty really had everybody looking at the value that they offer to clients. And I think it's a very easy conversation to have with a client that says, actually, we've assessed whether we can offer you value, and for the fee that we charge you, we don't think we are. So we're going to let that fee go to you because we can't provide, you know, a multiplication of that fee as a value, which is what I want to do with clients. And you can keep that. And it's not a contentious conversation. It's not hard. Clients tend to say, actually, well, thanks. That's helpful.
Yeah.
And to put some numbers on that, just to, you know, this isn't just an idea. This is something we've been through. We deal with somewhere between 20 and 30% fewer client households today than we did 3 or 4 years ago.
Yep.
But we, our revenues and our profit margins are higher than they were at that point. So we, it's been a very deliberate, very conscious process that we've dealt with sensitively with the clients where we've had those conversations.
And do you ever have a client that sort of says, no, I don't want to go?
There's a couple who just who say, well, you might not, you know, when you've done your assessment of fair value, you might not see the value, but just in having you there, that's a comfort value for us that we're prepared to pay a fee for. So we have a minimum fee option that that gives people that kind of comfort blanket. But we try to be pretty pretty sure that we can demonstrate the value delivery as well as just, you know, not just going, oh, well, every one of those clients we spoke to wanted to pay the minimum fee for comfort. Like, that isn't the outcome. It's got to be a proper, you know, grown-up two-way conversation with them.
Carl, I see you, you're nodding there.
Yeah, I echo everything Alistair said there. And I think sometimes as an industry, we always come at it more as a financial advisor first and an attachment to those clients. So we're scared to turn those fees off, or we turn scared to lose the relationship with those clients. We've gone through a very similar process to Alistair, and I can honestly say it's had a significantly positive impact on our business too, in terms of productivity and profitability ultimately as well. And, you know, I think it comes down to how you phrase it, how it's proposed to the client, and ultimately we're trying to do them a favour. And ultimately, taking Peter's point again before, you know, as leaders or managing directors, owners of businesses, we're there to make a profit and be efficient. We're not there to be a slave to the business, working 24/7. And if you cannot deliver a positive outcome for those clients for what they're paying, there should be no shame in actually having that conversation with the client. Most of our clients, well, I can't think of an example, so I'd say, I wouldn't like to say all, but 99.9% of all the clients have not had an issue with the proposition we've made. And we're not actually closing the clients. We're just turning the fees off and saying, we will not proactively manage you. But if ever you need anything, you can always come back to us and we will charge accordingly as and when you need us. So we're not disposing them and leaving them high and dry. They've still got an option if they need it and come back to us, you know, every 2, 3, 4 years rather than sort of being forced to pay it, so to speak.
Yeah, and I suppose it comes into the vulnerable clients. I mean, I think a lot of advisors are of the mind that it's only a yearly cup of tea with a client and it's no skin off our nose. What do you, what's your approach?
So we've been going for 9 years and I suppose we would probably be every business consultant's nightmare or ideal client, perhaps, because they're all about efficiencies and profitability, which we are to some extent. But at the same time, we set up that business 9 years ago, and there's some clients that were maybe with us at the outset, because, of course, our ideal target client has evolved over those 9 years. And if you were sitting in an office waiting for your ideal target clients when you just start, you know, we've families to feed and bills to pay. So, yeah, there probably was some clients in the early days that you took on that weren't your perfect, typical client. But they've been with you from the start. And it is difficult to suddenly, when you get to this stage of growth, to sort of say, no, let's just, you know, cut them loose. But as a similar situation, as Carol was saying, that, you know, yes, we maybe switch off our fees, but we're here if they ever need us. And or some have said, actually, we do value even that limited service that you provide. Can we just continue with that? And as long as they're happy to pay the fee for the service we're delivering and they're receiving or perceiving value from that, then we see that as fine.
I think it's important to note that we are younger businesses this side and they're older businesses. And at some stage, you know, in business growth, you're going to have to change. You know, you can't be the business you were at the start. And that's just natural. Every business goes through that. So at some point, you've got to kind of relook at everything you're doing and maybe change your niche or change your branding or change whatever. But change is inevitable in every business, especially as you grow, because you can't remain that same handcrafted business that maybe we started. You know, we're probably coming into that phase. And so it depends on the age of the business as to how you're looking at these issues as well.
And talking of changing branding, you know, we have the great wealth transfer. I guess for the two in the middle here, because Spentwell is quite a young firm. You've just rebranded, and it looks a lot more techy and sort of. But what about you guys? I mean, what are you doing to sort of, I suppose, appeal to the younger generation?
Yeah, again, we rebranded, I think it's 5 years ago now. Well, not rebranded, sorry. We evolved our brand 5 years ago. And again, I just think it's part of the journey of most businesses. And again, I think a lot of people miss it as business owners, complacently just keeping doing what they've always done. And I do think you should always evolve, and you should never fear evolving either, because our industry is always going to do so. Certainly since we did that 5 years ago, again, it helps us become more attractive to the type of client we want. It helps engage those younger generations, and as we say, the wealth transfer from families, from the older generations to younger ones. I think if you are seen to be a younger firm, or you are seen to move with the times and you are more dynamic, you probably have got a better chance of hanging on to those clients. I think if you look and feel and portray an image of a 20, 30 or 50 year old business, you probably struggle to get some of those younger clients to stay with you. So I do think it's a massive part of our job as directors and owners of business, is we have to move with the times, and we have to prove to the outside world that we are doing so.
Keith, what do you think? How do you appeal to the younger people?
Yeah, I mean, I'm maybe quite idealistic with this viewpoint, but I think we can do good by people regardless of where they are in the journey. Mm. So, you know, if you've watched any Disney film, think of Cinderella, Aladdin, they were seen as irrelevant, they were in the basement, they were hidden away in the alleyway, and actually they went on and achieved great things as the story goes on. And I think we miss that at times with some of our clients that we say no to, or we turn away, and actually there's an opportunity where we can reframe that, be it guidance, sharing knowledge, just doing right, doing good in local community, being present, and I think that carries a lot of value, or just giving one-off pieces of advice. Some people don't like that because they think there's danger for the rest of the year for that client. But some people just need one-off piece of advice. They just need a plan. Mm. They just need to be able to step in the car, you know, and get going. And they can come back in 10 years' time or whenever.
Did you mention that you try to educate or do some sort of financial education around your clients and their children?
Yes. So we'll offer out complimentary guidance sessions to clients' children. So we work with Red Start Educate in the local schools, so we do that, and we'll offer out complimentary guidance sessions to their kids with a view that we can give them, because we don't get this in school, we don't get the foundational knowledge.
Yeah.
We come out with all the nuts and bolts loose.
Yeah.
So if you can give them an education, when it comes to them earning or the big decisions like buying a house or saving, who will they engage with first?
Mm.
It'll be the person that cared about them when they were Cinderella or when they were Aladdin in the alleyway or in the basement.
Yeah.
That's my opinion on it anyway.
I think coming back to the start, I mean, as advice firms, you know, we've seen the death of the high street. People don't want to shop anymore. They want to do everything online. We have loads of D2C options available. Why come to a financial advisor rather than, you know, Vanguard or AJ Bell? Alistair, what do you think?
I'll get on my soapbox just for a second here, if that's okay. I run a completely non-commercial website called UK Personal Finance. We have a guide for people that is start to finish how to manage your finances from never thought about it, called the UK Personal Finance Flowchart. We get like 30,000 unique visitors a month to the website. It has nothing to do with the business. It's a completely different project. At that point in people's lives, at the point at which they're in their teens, 20s, maybe early 30s, the stakes are so much lower. So my opinion is there just isn't a need, particularly, unless life circumstances are very specific, for the kind of what is, frankly, on a universal scale, highly regulated, highly expensive, highly specialised advice, which is what the people in this room provide. So when the stakes are low, I think it's brilliant that we've democratised access to this sort of stuff. You know, I've helped develop some of that democratised information. But what you don't get in all of that is wisdom. And that's what people are prepared to pay for when the stakes get higher. So one of the biggest questions we have in this community, in this kind of non-commercial community, is people come in and they go, well, you know, I've done this. I've bought, you know, Vanguard World Index on Vanguard's platform. And now my mum and dad have come and asked me about their pension, and like they're coming to retirement, and I've basically just told them to do the same thing. What do you think? you know, there'll be people like holding their heads in their hands in this room, right? Because the stakes are higher. Making a mistake at that point is really costly. Mm. That's where we can maximise the value we add as planners.
Yeah.
So today's 20-year-olds, while the stakes are low, in 30 years will be the next generation's 50-year-olds where the stakes are high.
Yeah.
I don't think that we're doing ourselves a disservice by focusing on the area where we can maximise our value.
Mm.
I'll put the soapbox away.
Carl, what do you think?
Yeah, again, I echo everything Alice has said there. The key words that, again, have always been drummed into me from an early age in my career, and again, we've alluded to them earlier on, it's around that experience, it's around that significant knowledge, it's around that relationship and that personality that we all have, which ultimately is there to reassure and make those clients feel comfortable in the decisions that they make.
Mm.
And again, I totally agree, there is a place for technology, there's a place for simplified advice, robo advice, call it what you want. There's a place for all of it, for us all, because society is that big and we're only sort of capturing a small amount of it now anyway. So I think, you know, it is around about that adding value, which it is hard to do, isn't it? Nobody wakes up on a morning and thinks, I need a financial advisor, I'm going to go and get it sorted. So, you know, it is all about that adding value, and hopefully, you know, we can attract more people to avoid the pitfalls. And to be fair to the guy, I don't know whether many people saw Martin Lewis on Wednesday night. Well, I think it was Wednesday night or Tuesday night, I think. You know, even he was saying on the pension specialist show that he did, he said, if you're unsure, go and speak specialist advice, which you don't normally get those TV programmes actually telling the audience to come our way. So,
What about the bigger advice firms? What about, how can the smaller and independent advice firms set themselves apart from, say, Quilter or SJP? What do you think, Keith?
I always get quite excited when consolidation happens and you see some of the bigger players scooping up other players and so on. Because what I see is ultimately it then just removes them, takes them one step back away from the client.
Mm.
You know, if you think of experiences, so think of McDonald's. It's very process-driven. Does anyone really feel connected or warm to McDonald's? Not really. You know what you're going to get. It's a certain standard, but not beyond that. Mm. Whereas the authentic, real experiences, there's a restaurant in Edinburgh called Three Birds. It's local, it's phenomenal food, and it's memorable, and it's warm and cozy, and I just want to go there because I'm really close to the owners there. Like, I'm literally a couple of steps away from them, and they're milling about. They really know the food. You know, they're passionate about it. Mm. So you feel so connected. You almost feel part of the business.
Yeah.
And I think that's the opportunity we've got at smaller firms. You can give a more authentic, closer experience, and clients can feel that. They then feel part of the firm.
Yeah. I think on that note, we might open up the floor for some questions. If anyone has a question. Yep, this gentleman up here. Sorry. Thank you.
Hi. Hey, I was just wondering if any of you have used, I assume some of you use model portfolios to make things more streamlined, but has anyone used ACDs before? And if you have, how has that affected the business?
Has anyone? No?
No.
No. Sorry.
Simple answer.
anyone else have any questions? Yep, this gentleman here. In front. Thank you.
With Consumer Duty, everybody talks about value. How do you demonstrate value to your clients?
We did quite a lot on this. If you're happy for me to take the answer, I think the key thing is thinking about where the interventions that we would have would give a. As I said this before, it's a really long and messy word, but it's a multiplicative result on our fees. So we all know that at some point in, I don't know, let's say 5 years of dealing with a client, we're going to have an intervention in their financial planning decision making that's going to significantly outstrip the last 5 years of fees, right? So that might be an inheritance tax, that's the easiest one, an inheritance tax planning conversation. What we're trying to do, and we don't do this with every client. I know firms that do literally document these every year with every client, and they have a value list. This is the theoretical thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of pounds we've saved you. And they have that on the back page of their annual review reports. But we took a demonstrative kind of cross-section across our clients, and we went back 4 or 5 years of reviews, and we said, okay, well, let's tot up what have our interventions saved or earned or sort of rewarded those clients with. And I mean, I'm a financial planning evangelist, so I knew the answer was going to be good, but I was surprised at how good that answer was when we actually sat down and looked at it in detail. That goes inside our fair value assessment folder, alongside our kind of costing, you know, the top-down stuff that the regulator wants you to do. I'd be really, really happy to have a conversation with a desktop reviewer about that and talk about the great value we offer our clients.
Does anyone else have any thoughts?
I was going to add documenting. It's always hard to document that value. You've got your typical, you can do a survey, you can a feedback survey to clients. But one thing, a tool we've been using, an AI recording tool in meetings, and that's been really good at picking up things that I wouldn't necessarily document or write down because I'm focused on the client, but it's focusing on the client feedback that they're giving you at meetings that records and documents that. So it's almost you've got that sort of first-hand feedback on file and documented, which is the hard bit.
Great. Hello. Yep, this gentleman here.
Keith, you mentioned about taking notes from clients through AI. I'd be interested what your process is and what tools you use.
So for taking notes, so I use Otter AI. So all my meetings are typically done over Zoom. The little Otter bot will join the meeting. I will tell the client in advance, and I'll tell them at the start of the meeting. There are little friends in the room, and most of them just laugh that there's an Otter in the room. And that just sits silently in the background and then records the meeting. Does it get it 100% perfect? No, it doesn't. But it also does an audio transcription, and I'll video record the call as well, so it covers all bases. I think the big thing, it gives you takeaways from that. So Otter is one of those. Saturn AI is more aligned to financial services, which then identifies vulnerabilities and so on. So we've trialed that, which is quite interesting. And I think the big benefit is, and it goes back to the point we've just mentioned there, it captures some key information for us, but also captures things that we might otherwise miss in some of the action points. Oh, God, yeah, they did say that. That's great. That I'd maybe missed in the conversation because I was already thinking about the next question or you know whatever. So I think it's almost like having an extra colleague in the room, like having your paraplanner in the room with you. Pretty invaluable.
In the same way, you can't be a slave to SatNav, you can't be a slave to AI as well, because Nicola had a very interesting case. Yeah. And it might be the Scottish accent, which is notoriously difficult to standardise on AI. But
I asked the client had a hip replacement, and I said, oh, how's he getting on? And he was healing quite well. But when I went to the recording, it said he's recovering well from his hip replacement, and he was cutting chickens within 3 months. Now he's a golfer and he's putting and chipping within 3 months, not cutting chickens, so it comes with a warning. It's good, but still not quite perfect.
I think we have time for one more question. Who do I pick? Yep, the guy just over here. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. Very interesting to listen to you all. I've got a specific question for Jenny and Nikki in particular, because you mentioned a very low number of take-up of new clients every year. I think it was 5, you said. Well, we all, and I'm sure you do, get recommendations from your existing clients because they love us and for what we do. Presumably you're getting more than 5 recommendations. I know they've got to fit the criteria, but are you reaching a point where you've got to expand more than that? Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I mean, we've got 403 clients. We only started the business 10 years ago. So if you do the maths, it's not 5 clients a year. But, you know, what I'm saying is we don't try to be the growth business in that we haven't been buying client banks and expanding rapidly. We've been just doing consistently and getting those referrals through doing a good job for existing clients. So we have already had our 5 clients in January for this year. So, you know, it does go at a pace, and, you know, we are trying to grow our own to cope with that and to develop other people to take the load on that.
I think this gentleman, did you have a question?
Yes.
Yep, sure. Can we get a mic over here? Oh, sorry.
Question for Keith. I think a lot of the old, I'm here. A lot of the old school around here, which tends to be the majority in any room of financial advisors, when you said you had 70 clients, looked at one another and thought, what the heck does he do all day? Is that your optimum number of clients? Are you looking to expand, or do you think that should be a ceiling?
That's funny. I'm growing, so it'll expand beyond 70. In terms of, I think this is the exciting thing, is that with the growth of AI, and it's just going to get better and better. So my mindset was the sweet spot was probably 100 clients that I could serve and serve well. I've got external consultants that feed into me, and that would be the sort of tipping point. But I think now with the power of AI, I think that 100 clients is now 150. Mm. And actually, I'm probably wrong with the estimate, because these clever little bots are going to keep jumping in and doing some of the stuff where I don't really add value for me, and then I can streamline and be in front of clients more. Mm. So I think that's quite exciting. Does that answer your question? Sorry, was that? Yeah.
Great. I think we've actually run out of time. How quick is this question?
I can give you the question. We can always talk about it after. I'm going to embarrass myself in terms of golfing knowledge here, but it was mentioned before. Now, I understand that certain golf pros have really led the game by getting really good at the 10-foot putt. Mm. And that's what they focus their attention on. If there was an equivalent for business growth in financial services for the 10-foot putt, what would you say it is? One thing that you should get really good at to drive growth?
I'll evangelize about financial planning again, if that's okay. It is really, transitioning a business that's more traditionally transactional and dealing with sort of investment-focused work. Investments are important, don't get me wrong. But transitioning that into a financial planning firm where we are really truly focusing on the person in front of us and their sort of future life in the context of their money, completely transformed our business, allowed us to develop a niche, allowed us to develop expertise, improved existing relationships, allowed us to have new ones. So if there was one thing, it would be that focus on, you might call it lifetime financial planning as a business model.
Great. Is anyone else dying to answer that?
I was just going to say, I think that the one thing that I would say, I'm going to have two words, but they're intrinsically linked. The one thing is strategy. I think your business needs a strategy. If you don't have one, why should we put a plan in place for our clients if we don't want to have one ourselves? And the actual way of delivering that strategy, which we've not really pushed on today, is brand. I think you have to really build a solid brand to help attract those people to come to you, and that's your business great. Will fly.
That's great. Okay, I'm sure everybody would like to join me in thanking our panelists for joining us today. Thank you.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.